It is Monday, September the 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, North Korea tests a hydrogen bomb, and that might create an onslaught of refugees going to China.
That's China's problem. It created the problem. Now it has to solve it. That is a problem, but a much greater problem would be a thermonuclear war or simply the North Koreans invading the South.
Kenya's election woes, health hazards from Harvey, plus Dobie Gray remembered. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. North Korea has conducted its sixth and most powerful nuclear test so far, which says it has advanced a hydrogen bomb for a long-range missile. VOA's Lori London speaks with security expert Jamil Jaffer for his insight.
Certainly a very much larger explosion than we've seen in the past. I think estimates currently are between 9 to 10 times the prior size of a detonation we've seen from the North Koreans.
If this is a hydrogen bomb, as North Korea claims, how big of a deal is this?
I mean, well, if it is a hydrogen bomb, either way, it's a very big deal. Obviously, it's six nuclear tests, the second in about a year, and, you know, concerning because of the size of the weapon. If it is a hydrogen bomb, that represents a significant change in North Korean capability because it shows their ability to use a two-stage nuclear weapon, which is to say a fission weapon combined with a fusion weapon, a fission weapon that initiates a fusion reaction.
What exactly does that mean?
What that essentially means is you can get a lot more explosive power out of the same size weapon.
Okay, so a hydrogen bomb would be more significant than just an ordinary nuclear test?
Exactly right. Exactly right. So a normal nuclear test, a normal fission weapon can create an a large amount of explosive power. Hydrogen bomb, large amount of explosive power, same size package.
Do we have the capability of finding this out, whether it was, in fact, a hydrogen bomb?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, you know, they're doing tests now. The Japanese are flying close therein to get radiation samples. And best way to know is to gauge by the size of the explosion and some of the other signs around it. Not clear that we'll know for sure it's a hydrogen bomb, but certainly, you know, concerning situation there on the peninsula.
What do the events that have just transpired say about the intention of Kim Jong-un?
Well, look, it's been clear for a while that Kim Jong-un intends to obtain a nuclear capability and intends to expand on that capability, which is to say increasing the number of tests, increasing the number of warheads is available, increasing the explosive capacity of those warheads. And then ultimately, combined with what we've seen from his ballistic missile program, which is increasing the range of his ballistic missiles, ultimately to mate up that ballistic missile program with the nuclear weapon program in order to try and have the capability to at least threaten to deliver a nuclear weapon a long distance. And so what you saw in addition to the test are some photographs released of Kim Jong-un inspecting what purports to be a warhead that could be mated with a intercontinental ballistic missile nose cone, which again is a troubling attempt by him to show the ability to mate both the nuclear capability, the weapon capability, with the delivery capability in the ballistic missiles.
So this whole photo op, what does that say, that he's releasing these photos?
It's certainly designed to send a message, right? And that message is very clear, which is I intend to increase my nuclear weapons capability, and I intend to increase my ballistic missiles weapons capability, combine the two, and make it a nuclear ballistic missile delivery capable system, which is an intercontinental ballistic missile delivery system. And so I intend to have the capability, if I choose to attack a large range of countries with a nuclear weapon. That's the message he's sending. He's also sending a message that he has that capability today, which is, you know, that might be a little more propaganda, right? We're not sure whether that warhead, in fact, is the one that exploded in the underground tunnel. We're not sure whether it's actually capable of being mounted. What you saw in the picture was a nose cone and a warhead and then a diagram showing how that nose cone, that warhead might be mounted in the nose cone. Again, unclear whether any of those parts are real. In the past, North Korea has shown us weapons designs that aren't fully capable yet. Mm-hmm. But what's also troubling is that over time, those weapons designs they've shown us before have actually matured mm-hmm. into capabilities. And so that's what's particularly troubling here.
But are there any military options that are actually feasible to stop him at this point?
The military options are not easy. They will involve, you know, if we turn to some sort of a war, significant loss of life on both sides. North Korea has a tremendous number of conventional, that is to say, non-nuclear weapons, directly across the border from South Korea in the demilitarized, just outside the demilitarized zone. And Seoul is just an hour's drive from the demilitarized zone, and that's half of a good chunk, or at least a good chunk of South Korea's 50 million population is in that Seoul region. So that's a concern also.
So what happens now?
It's a great question. I mean, you heard Secretary of Defense James Mattis make clear that any further threats by North Korea will result in a massive military response. Here you've got a nuclear test, but not a direct threat to the United States or its allies. But the sort of the circumstances obviously are very threatening. You saw a few days ago a missile launch over Japan into the ocean, troubling thing. And so the overall effect is certainly concerning.
Jamil Jaffer is a security expert. He was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. Well, some observers say North Korea's bomb test marks a dramatic escalation of the regime's standoff with the U.S. as well as its allies. South Korea's military carried out a missile drill today in response to that nuclear test. And later today, the U.N. Security Council will meet to discuss fresh sanctions against the regime of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. And then the U.S. Defense Chief Jim Mattis says President Trump has asked to be briefed on all available military options. Mattis also delivered a strong message to North Korea about its provocative actions.
We are not looking to the total annihilation of a country, namely North Korea. But as I said, we have many options to do so.
And Secretary of Treasury here in the United States, Steve Mnuchin, says he will put together a package of new sanctions to potentially cut off all trade with North Korea. Peter Morrissey is an American economist and a professor of international business in the Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. He's responded to the North Korean bomb test by saying it is time for the U.S. to play the China card. In other words, with Beijing holding many of the keys to dealing with North Korea, they have done very little so far. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Dr. Morrissey about the China factor in all of this.
China essentially finances North Korea through trade. It has Chinese laborers within its borders and it remits the money to the Chinese government, purchases Chinese textiles, and it sells China natural gas. Real sanctions would be to cut all that off and basically starve the regime. But it doesn't want to do that. Enabling North Korea creates a great deal of discomfort for the United States and strategically ties down the United States, distracts them from, for example, Chinese expansionism in the South China Sea, the problems over trade, and so forth. What's more, North Korea will soon be in the position to make conventional incursions into South Korea if it chooses, and to basically say to the United States, if you respond, we'll launch a nuclear missile. Either it could be to South Korea, it could be to Japan, or it could be to Hawaii or the mainland United States. We are simply creating a monster by permitting China to use North Korea as a foil.
You know, of course, China has argued that a collapse of the regime in North Korea would result in a major refugee crisis.
That's China's problem. It created the problem. Now it has to solve it. That is a problem. But a much greater problem would be a thermonuclear war or simply the North Koreans invading the South. The situation has North Korea has created a situation in which its regime is now unstable in the sense that the peninsula is in disequilibrium. China has enabled that, and now China has to fix it. If it brings enough pressure to bear on North Korea will have to change its policies.
The state-run Global Times in China editorialized that any move against cutting off North Korea's oil supply or shutting down its border would be a big problem.
It certainly would be. But they should have thought about that 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, when North Korea went down this path and they chose not to constrain. Remember, North Korea is a client state of Beijing. Beijing has created a monster, and now it must quell it. If it doesn't, then the road to solving this problem for the United States is not invading North Korea, not taking a conventional action, not dropping a nuclear bomb, or anything like that. All of those are terrible options for a variety of reasons. One of them is the vulnerability of South Korea. The answer is to put such pressure on China that it's no longer worth it to support North Korea and to somehow or other deal with the refugee problem that might follow.
You cited former Defense Secretary Robert Gates proposing possible two choices for China. What are those?
Well, essentially, China can continue to support North Korea and permit it to develop nuclear weapons, or it can finally shut down its access to cash by cutting off the textile imports, by sending home the laborers, and if necessary, cutting off the petroleum supplies. It's really up to China to decide what to do about this. But if it doesn't, then the United States really has no choice but to respond by making it very costly, not for North Korea, but for China. We can populate the region with anti-ballistic missiles and shoot down anything that moves, anything that even remotely looks like an intercontinental ballistic missile. We can put pressure on China in the South China Sea, much greater pressure than we're putting on them now, and we can make their life miserable when it comes to trade. You know, if we make China's life miserable on trade, we're going to pay more for toaster ovens at Walmart. Instead of $20 like they are this weekend on sale, they're going to be $30, and they'll be made someplace else, perhaps Indonesia or even the United States. But for China, people will be rioting in Tiananmen Square. What China really needs to worry about, what it really needs to worry about, is not a flood of immigrants from North Korea, but another Tiananmen Square if we start shutting down its factories by not accepting its goods. Now China's got real simple choices. It either deals with North Korea, or we should deal with China. Of course, what Beijing is banking on is that Mr. Trump is not much different than Mr. Obama. Mr. Obama would, they say, in the women say when it comes to sewing, measure twice, cut once. But Mr. Obama, it was measure 15 times, never cut at all. It's now time to see, having taken the measure of China, whether Trump is really willing to act. This is simply one of those times in history. This is, you know, Trump's Munich moment. Is he going to be Chamberlain or Churchill? That's what it comes down to.
Peter Morrissey is a renowned economist. He's also a professor of international business in the Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Kenya's opposition leader Raila Odinga says his coalition will not share power with President Uhuru Kenyatta. This came only a few days after the country's Supreme Court annulled last month's presidential election victory for Kenyatta based on what they identified as irregularities. Kenyatta insists a new poll should be rerun with the current electoral board. Odinga disagrees and, in fact, wants Kenya's Electoral Commission to be disbanded. We asked John Campbell, senior fellow in Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, if Odinga is asking for too much.
The Supreme Court ruling is interesting because it holds at fault the Electoral Commission. In other words, not Kenyatta, but rather the Commission. And so there is a certain logic in Odinga calling for the Electoral Commission to be dissolved and replaced.
Dr. Campbell says he was both surprised and pleased at the Supreme Court ruling. And then we asked, what does all of this mean for the continent, where countries such as Zimbabwe, Burundi, and Uganda are saying Kenya is an example to be followed?
Well, indeed, because what does the Supreme Court ruling show? It shows the independence of the judiciary, and that's something that is fairly rare and unusual in Africa. It's certainly true of South Africa, where the judiciary has played a leading role in curtailing Jacob Zuma's efforts to amend the Constitution in various ways. But it's fairly rare. And One of the things I think is quite clear from the Kenyan people's reaction is that it surprised them also, and it also pleased them. Lots of reports that Kenyans feel that the demonstration of the independence of the judiciary is more important than whether it's Kenyatta or Odinga who ends up being president.
Kenya's law is requiring now that new polling for president take place within 60 days.
It does indeed. And so there will be, I think, elections in 60 days. But from a certain perspective, these are fairly perilous times. What the Supreme Court decision did was, at least for the moment, it seems to have united, if not all Kenyans, a great many Kenyans, around the principle of the independent judiciary and the rule of law. The question will be, as we go into the next round of elections, whether that can continue to trump tribal identities. And after all, up to now, tribal identities have been the most important element in Kenyan politics.
And on the subject of election-related violence, Dr. Campbell says no matter who the next president will be, there likely will be violence because Kenya's history has proved violence often accompanies elections there. John Campbell is a senior fellow in Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This time last week, the coast of the U.S. state of Texas was being pounded by what was, and at times still remain, Hurricane Harvey, causing massive flooding. Those floodwaters are now beginning to recede in many areas, including the city of Houston, which was hard hit. VOA's Carol Pearson reports, with the high water receding, health hazards from all of this are not going away anytime soon.
The sight is amazing. More than 3.5 trillion liters of water fell on Houston and southeast Texas for 5 consecutive days. Aerial views show just about everything underwater. Now that Hurricane Harvey has moved on, the danger has not ended. Downed power lines electrocuted at least 2 volunteer rescuers when their boat hit the power lines they couldn't see. And a young man died when he stepped into electrified water when he went home to search for his sister's cat. Jodel Pasek, his mother, said her son's last words were, "I'm dying," as he warned a friend not to follow him.
They couldn't even help my son. They couldn't resuscitate him. He was in electrified water.
Virginia Rogers Grasso and many others fled their homes at a moment's notice.
About 11 o'clock, some little guys came and rang the doorbell and told us it was mandatory you have to leave, that your house is fixing to be flooded.
People with diabetes didn't have time to collect life-saving medications like insulin. Others left without blood pressure or cholesterol-controlling drugs. The Centers for Disease Control, local hospitals and pharmacies are helping out. Doctors have volunteered their time to help with routine medical care. But with lots of water and daytime temperatures in the 30s, Houston is a perfect breeding ground for mosquitoes and bacteria. As the water recedes, mold and respiratory problems caused by mold can increase. Water-soaked walls, insulation, furniture, and carpeting can cause illness or even death. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study from researchers led by Sukrit Ranjan of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics suggests ultraviolet light may have played a major role in the development of life on Earth and might be something that could help scientists search for life in the universe. Ranjan and his colleagues came across this possibility after studying red dwarf stars. He says the research suggests these type of stars, which are cooler and smaller than those like our own sun, might not be able to produce the quantity of UV light that could stimulate the sort of life-giving and sustaining processes we have on Earth. Ranjan says it's like having everything you need to start a fire, like wood and kindling, but you don't have a match. He likens the proper amount of ultraviolet light as a kind of match that could ignite the formation of life. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. In our report from the music department, we're remembering the 5 decades career of a master of song.
Ever since the day I met you, I feel like I'm walking on air. And lately I'm convinced it's no coincidence. I run into you everywhere. And though I've heard your love is taken, I gotta believe what's in your eyes. Would I be out of line if I suggested a time? And we get together one of these nights. Got my heart set on you. You're everything I ever wanted.
Born Lawrence Darrow Brown in 1940 near Houston, Texas, Dobie Gray went on to become a huge hitmaker as a singer-songwriter whose musical career spans soul, country, and pop.
Give you the wrong impression. I'm not the kind who rushes in, but baby, every time I see you before I even leave you, I can hardly wait to see you again. Got my heart set on you. Oh, you're everything I ever wanted. Got my heart set on.
And Bud Renaud wrote Got My Heart Set on You for country artist John Conley in 1986. Conley's version went on to number one on the Hot Country Songs chart. Known as a smooth balladeer and soul singer, Dobie Gray's powerful Motown-like version of Bill Page's The In Crowd reached number 13 on Billboard's Hot 100 chart in February 1965, and number 25 in the UK, also in 1965.
I'm in with the in crowd. I go where the in crowd goes. I'm in with the in crowd. And I know what the
Dobie Gray's family sharecropped. He discovered gospel music through his grandfather, a Baptist minister. And then in the early 1960s, he moved to Los Angeles, hoping to become an actor while also singing on the side to make some money. Drift Away is a song by Minter Williams and originally recorded by John Henry Kurtz on his 1972 album Reunion. In 1973, the song became Dobie Gray's biggest hit, peaking at number 5 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, and it went gold.
Get lost in your...
In his later years, Dobie Gray began to write more and more country songs and moved to the country music capital of the U.S., Nashville, Tennessee. He died there in December 2011 at the age of 71.
The world outside looks so unkind, so I'm counting on you to carry me through.
You know, here about 45 years later, I still hear that song almost every day on satellite radio. Amazing, Dobie Gray. Listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. Latest world news straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Dobie Gray.
An editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the first Monday of September every year, the United States pauses to honor its workers and the contributions they make to our nation's prosperity. On September 5, 1882, more than 10,000 men and women paraded through the streets of Manhattan to celebrate the first Labor Day. New York's Central Labor Union organized the day of celebration in honor of the workers who fought to secure higher wages, shorter hours, and better working conditions for laborers. It was a day of celebration, but also a day of sacrifice. The workers sacrificed that day's wages to demonstrate their commitment to gaining fair compensation for hard work. American workers transformed the United States and the world with a quality of life never seen in history. American farmers export more food than any country in the world and produce food more efficiently per capita than China and India, the world's largest food producers. The United States exports more refined petroleum than any other country in the world, and it exports more than 40% of the world's spacecraft and aircraft, and more than 11% of the world's electronics. America has the largest road network of any country in the world, with over 6.5 million kilometers of road, over 4.3 million miles of paved road, and over 2.2 million miles of unpaved road. 90% of American households own at least one automobile, and American workers produce almost 3 million cars per year, nearly 5% of cars produced per year worldwide. A key element in America's economic success is the freedom that every American enjoys, the freedom to choose their work, the freedom to innovate and create new industries and revitalize old ones. What we are witnessing today is the renewal of the American spirit, said President Donald Trump. We do not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but rather to let it shine, said President Trump. We will shine as an example for everyone to follow.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.